Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Today's show, well, I have a gummy alert for you right out of the box, and a few stories about mind-altering substances that alter more than we thought and more than our minds, and a news flash about gum disease raising cholesterol. So stay tuned for a lot of interesting information tonight. And let's start with that gummy alert. So more and more medications, vitamins, supplements are being made into gummies. And there are some problems with that. One of the top problems is it's actually hard to make gummies, and so a lot of the manufacturers kind of make the gummy and then dip it in whatever the substance is and dry it and hope that all of the gummies ended up with the same amount. And obviously that's kind of not a really good idea. But a lot of these compounds, when they're added to the goo of the gummy, may interfere with the curing of the gummy. So in an effort to get that nice, consistent chomp and chew and that texture, they're, well, making some problems. For example, gummy melatonin, and this is an article that is not directly related to this story, but I did come across that this week in reviewing what was new in the news. And a study has come out showing that in children's gummies of melatonin, the doses are, they might say that it has 5 milligrams of melatonin, but actually the dose can vary by as much as 300% in the upward direction. And that would be a technical, that would be a technical overdose. Now, of course, we recommend generally for sleep that very low doses of melatonin are used. So 5 milligrams was an example, but really, that would not be a children's dose in the first place. Now, the problem with gummies is, besides the fact that it may not have as much as it says or may have more, is that if you're taking several different kinds, you can rapidly reach a toxic level of sugar alcohol. And so the gummy alert is for people who are noticing increased intestinal gas. And I've had a number of patients come in with that complaint as part of their physical in the last few months. And it was only recently that I thought to ask, not what supplement are you taking, like how much vitamin D, but also in what form, whether you're taking it, if you're taking it as a gummy, you may be exceeding your tolerance. Now, gas and diarrhea and abdominal cramping are the big signs of this. And the culprits are the sugar alcohols, xylitol being the most common one. And I took a look at some of my favorite products. You'll also see mannitol, sorbitol, those are OL. And they're notorious for causing abdominal cramping, bloating, and diarrhea. And how many is too many? Well, for some of them, just 2 different products taken as gummies can be enough to get your xylitol levels up to the low teens, and that's enough in a lot of people to set them off. I'm also not a real fan of soluble tapioca fiber for a number of reasons, which I don't care to go into at the moment, but there are things that are done in the production of that really turn that into an ultra-processed food. And therefore, what we know about tapioca in the diet as a as our knowledge base has nothing to do with tapioca in gummies. And there may be, for example, a more diabetogenic aspect to this than we actually realize. So check the labels, look for sugar alcohols, xylitol, sorbitol, mannitol. It'll end in OL. And if you feel funny after taking them, find another form. I want to also emphasize that the diarrhea caused by these sweeteners can last up to 3 days after stopping intake. So it can be very hard to spot it. You may think you're getting a lot of stomach or stomach flu or food poisoning. That was one of the people who came in. I keep getting food poisoning. I keep getting diarrhea and cramping, and you know, having problems for three days, and then 2 weeks later it happens again. Turns out that they were stacking occasional cannabis gummies on top of supplement gummies, and they were crossing that magic threshold, and it was taking a while to wear off. So if you're a gummy user, first of all, explore other options, and second of all, keep your doses low. I would recommend no more than 6 milligrams a day of sugar alcohols. But for some people, that may still be too much. All right, so let's go to our first email. So this was from Linda in Felton, and I'll just read the whole thing. Thank you for your excellent podcast. I greatly appreciate all the medical information that you provide to the community. You're good at explaining complex information for almost anyone to understand. I'm writing with a question about abdominophrenic dyssynergia, which you discussed in your November 13th episode. The condition closely matches my symptoms, particularly progressive abdominal distension after eating that worsens during the day and resolves overnight. I'm a healthy 77-year-old female. I've undergone extensive evaluation and dietary trials, including long-term gluten avoidance, elimination and low FODMAP diets, and imaging to rule out structural causes or abnormal growths. I was treated with Fosamax for approximately 8 years in my early 60s and resumed it in 2020. In 2024, I discontinued the medication after learning it can cause GI side effects. That change significantly improved my GI discomfort, though the abdominal distension has persisted. I'm hoping you might offer guidance on how to find a professional experienced in treating abdominophrenic dyssynergia, particularly for retraining the diaphragm and abdominal wall. For what I see online, it may involve breathing exercises and biofeedback. So for the audience, abdominophrenic dyssynergia is an abnormal reflex where the diaphragm drops and the abdominal wall relaxes. And, of course, you've heard of diaphragmatic breathing. And so sometimes people may actually have triggered a small case of this myself at one point in my life by really forcing the diaphragmatic breathing. I was really trying to get the feel for it, but I think I was actually forcing it too far down, and I had these symptoms for a while, but I was young and they gradually resolved. So noticeable swelling of the abdomen after meals. You definitely need to check for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and low stomach acid. You check for the latter by taking apple cider vinegar or betaine hydrochloride, about 2,000 milligrams of the betaine hydrochloride, or about 2 tablespoons of the apple cider vinegar for the initial testing. And you can dilute the vinegar in water, and it still works. Another symptom is bloating, just pressure and trapped feeling, and fullness and discomfort in the upper abdomen. And it's just a problem with the gut-brain reflexes, and it's often associated with irritable bowel syndrome and core muscle weakness. Sometimes it occurs after a surgery, particularly if the abdominal wall muscles are and impacted by the surgery directly. A specialist can test this. A physical therapy assessment would confirm your paradoxical movement of the diaphragm with breathing. And the best treatment is EMG-guided biofeedback, so that's going to happen in a specialized physical therapy center. So that's what I would do. I would do a question prompt. I'm going to give you an AI search engine question. I am a patient with abdominophrenic dyssynergia, and I live at blah blah address, include the zip code. Where is the nearest physical therapy center that would provide biofeedback for my condition? And I believe that if you phrase your prompt more or less exactly as I've stated, that the system, the AI system, will be able to search the vault, so to speak, and go through all the physical therapy places in a gradually widening circle and come back panting after less than a second or two to provide you with its tail wagging with the locations and phone numbers that you need to contact. So I think that's a good use for AI in medicine. And so sometime we'll do a larger program about that, but I think I'm going to need a helper to really make that work for the audience. So anyone who has a desire to volunteer to do that program with me, you can go ahead and reach out to askdrdon.com, hit the contact us, and step forward, because I think it would be a useful show. All right, so we're moving on to the things that can alter things we weren't sure how they did it, and we weren't sure whether we wanted them to. This one came from a meeting of the American Chemical Society, and you know those chemists, they're always snipping away at the molecules, adding an active group here, changing things around to get a new molecule that can, well, let's face it, sell and patent. Now we're working on psilocybin, and there is a candidate moving forward. I can't say I'm entirely glad to see this research. Despite its therapeutic promise, you know, psilocybin, taking at doses that affect major psychological change, can be associated with intense hallucinogenic effects, and it also makes it very difficult to do safely because of the person power that's needed to do a guided, expert-guided trip, let's call it, and the doses used are quite substantial, so there's a real risk of having things go sideways. So in research published in the American Chemical Society's recent Journal of Medicinal Chemistry, scientists created modified forms of psilocybin, the active compound produced when psilocybin is processed. In an early study involving mice, these new molecules maintain their biological activity while triggering fewer hallucinogenic-like effects than pharmaceutical-grade psilocybin. All right, so I'm going to start off by saying that I definitely do not know how you tell whether a mouse is tripping or not, but they think that they are doing this by seeing fewer head twitches. And I'm just like, I'm not sure that correlates all that well with tripping. So I guess we'll have to see when they start giving this molecule to humans whether it actually does what they think it's doing. But there's a lot of options of things that have emerged as being candidates for treatment with psilocybin. Many mood disorders, Alzheimer's disease, things that are linked to disruption in serotonin. Researchers have spent decades exploring psychedelics because of their influence on serotonin signaling, which is very great. But hallucinations can make patients, particularly elderly patients, hesitant to use them, so maybe there is a place for this research. What they did was they designed 5 chemical variants of psilocin, and they were designed to release the active molecule into the brain more slowly and subtly, because is thought that the rate of rise of the chemical in the brain is the key to the hallucinogenic high. And if you can just turn the heat up more slowly, so to speak, maybe you get less of that. And so they looked at human plasma samples. They looked at mice. They looked at conditions that simulate gastrointestinal absorption. They were looking for something that went into the mouth and got in, passed into the brain, and got into the bloodstream and passed into the brain, basically. They found one. They called it 4E, and it caused it was stable during gastrointestinal digestion, so all those acids and bases and proteases and et cetera didn't damage it. and it was gradual, so that they thought would be helpful for reducing the hallucinogenic response. And it continued to activate the serotonin levels, serotonin receptors. So they gave it to the mice orally and monitored them over 48 hours. It got into their brains, and it lasted longer than psilocybin does. And they had fewer head twitches, so maybe that means they were having fewer psychedelic-like activities. But when I said I'm sort of not happy to see this research, honestly, there's a lot of politics to medicine, as I would say, as much politics as there is science, really. And in this current situation, because psilocybin is such a benign way of inducing neuroplasticity, and it has such rapid results, and it's been shown to have benefits in addiction of all kinds. And how much money do we spend in rehab only to have it fail, right? So if we could double the effectiveness of rehab, which it in studies does more than, we could pay for it. We could pay for all of the intensive training that it would take to have people sitting with people. Some states in the United States have legalized it. I'm not sure that that's a great idea, but they've gone ahead and done it, so we've got the experiment to see how it goes. But if such a drug exists that doesn't cause a high and still does some or most of what native psilocybin does, then we'll never get it legalized nationally, because there will be, first of all, it won't just be puritanical, oh, tripping is bad. It will be, well, we've got something that does the same thing, and that whole that power base that represents big pharma will just lobby the heck out of our, let's just say, electorally vulnerable representatives who need lots and lots and lots of support to get reelected, because we never did get around to campaign finance reform, and it's in the interest of a great many people that we never do. But it's interesting to just play thought games when people are discussing what's happening in the world and think, what would the alternate universe where, you know, if you've got enough signatures on your ballot, you got to basically you get an amount of money to run for office and have to buy all your advertising through that money and, you know, go bake sales or something like that. But get rid of the private capital, and especially the corporate capital that funds our elections. Sorry, I'm straying away from medicine. Only really superficially, because as I said, there's at least as much politics in the medical policies that control what medicines we can receive, what medicines we can't receive, how our insurance works, how our safety net works. More politics than science in anything that costs money. All right, moving on to our next story. Brain scans reveal how ketamine quickly lifts severe depression. Scientists have finally visualized how ketamine rewires key brain receptors to rapidly relieve treatment-resistant depression. Now, ketamine was originally developed as an anesthetic and a tranquilizer and has mild hallucinogenic properties, strong anxiolytic properties. But we're going to talk just a moment about treatment-resistant depression. First of all, major depressive disorder is a major global health problem. It is one of the highest causes of disability. And about 30% of people diagnosed with severe depression develop treatment-resistant depression, which, of course, TRD, has initials and has its own ICD-10 code. But their symptoms do not improve sufficiently with standard antidepressant medications. Ketamine has gained attention as a fast-acting antidepressant for people, and we don't know how it works, or at least we haven't until this research came out. And it was The research came out of the Department of Physiology at Yokohama City University Graduate School of Medicine in Japan. Professor Takuya Takahashi was the lead author. And what the team did was they used an advanced positron emission tomography imaging, and you've probably heard of PET CT, but this was just PET, and it gives you a blurry picture, but it shows you fuzzy changes in brain activity. And they used a special kind, contrast agent that they'd observed, and they were directing their changes to a particular receptor that is abbreviated AMPAR, and you'll learn why in a moment. The name of the receptor is glutamate alpha amino 3-hydroxy-5-methyl-4-isoxylol propionic acid receptor, AMPAR. It plays an important role in synaptic plasticity, and quite honestly, this may be the target of the other hallucinogens like psilocybin as well. So they, as I said, they had a special tracer that honed in on AMPAR directly in the brain, looking at all of the areas of the brain that had high levels of it. And then they took 34 patients who had treatment-resistant depression and 49 who didn't. And the patients either received IV ketamine or placebo over a two-week period. They did brain imaging before the start and again after the final infusion. The results showed that people with treatment-resistant depression had widespread abnormalities of this receptor, AMPAR, in terms of its density in the brain compared to healthy participants. There were specific brain regions, some of which showed lower levels, some of which showed higher levels. Interestingly enough, the areas that showed higher levels have previously, in different research, been associated with the reward pathways, and those are run by dopamine. Don't know quite what to say about that, but they were dynamic changes over that two-week period. They saw that ketamine altered the distribution of the receptors. So in other words, the receptors moved. Some of them came up to the surface that were hiding down inside the cell, and some of them dropped back down. And the brains came to resemble those of the healthy controls more closely. And those changes and the degree of change tracked with improvements of the patient's symptoms. And 2 weeks of therapy is pretty darn rapidly. It just goes to show how fast the brain can change. Are you building those receptors? No, you're probably just submerging them to where they're inside the cell and can't be activated. But the fact that some went up and some went down is interesting. The fact that it happened that quickly is interesting. And the fact that it had such a profound effect on treatment-resistant depression is very important, because this has been one of the hardest nuts to crack in terms of helping with chronic depression. Our final story about mind-altering substances involves a study done at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. What they looked at were CBD and CBG. These are two non-intoxicating cannabis compounds. And they were interested in looking at whether they could help with metabolic health, particularly fatty liver disorder. Other research has shown that CBD and CBG increase the organ's ability to improve or heal from a fatty liver disorder situation. Metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease, that's the latest initials, but basically also known as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and there are, you know, various other initials indicating different grades of that. I'm not going to bore you with the alphabet soup, because that's not important. The point is, it's the most widespread chronic liver condition in the world, and it's growing quick. And it's growing quick with our waistlines. It's strongly associated with diabetes and prediabetes and metabolic syndrome. And globally, it affects about one-third of adults. It might be slightly higher in the United States. And it's also associated with high blood pressure, obesity, and insulin resistance. And we don't have good drugs. And doctors recommend lifestyle changes, like fix your diet and exercise more. But doctors aren't trained in how to help people achieve those things. And coaches are expensive. So big hole there in the therapeutic model, if you ask me. So let's look for some drugs. Well, CBD and CBG are out there. The researchers discovered that the liver's energy reserves were profoundly affected, particularly by CBG. The compounds increased levels of phosphocreatine. Now, phosphocreatine is kind of like an emergency energy supply in most cells. It's a backup source. But when liver cells are exposed to a high-fat diet, they have to work very, very hard. And so having a reserve tank that they can tap appeared to help them clear the fat and process it, which, of course, is what fatty liver disease is. It's a backlog of fat that hasn't been processed. It's a full inbox that just keeps getting fuller and fuller. They also found that CBD and CBG reactivate lysosomes through a compound called catepsin, but the lysosomes are the recycling centers within the cell. They get rid of unwanted material, break it down to smaller components so it can be flushed out. They also found that it reduced ceramides, which are harmful substances that cause inflammation in the liver. And as I said, the CBG turned out to be a little stronger than the CBD. Now, here's where I said, huh, I've read this entire newsletter article on it, and I still don't know what they were doing. Well, it turns out they were using mice. I went and looked up the method section. You've got to watch for those details. Went looked up the method section, and these mice were treated with a high-fat diet for 14 weeks to give them fatty liver disease. Then they were treated for 4 weeks with daily intraperitoneal CBD, CBG, or vehicle. And then they did all these assessments and all of these tests that would reflect things I've already talked about. But the problem is intraperitoneal means that you're injecting it into the abdominal cavity. So the liver, the outside of the liver, is just going to be bathed with this stuff. So there's really no way to say with any degree of certainty that that is meaningful for any drug development or any use. And it's so interesting that it was missing from the article because I guess they thought, tell people to use CBG and your fatty liver will go away. But you are going to put it in your mouth or smoke it. And the livers, the levels that you're going to achieve in your liver may not be anywhere near the levels that would be achieved and the duration that would be achieved. Because if you put it in your bloodstream, it's going into the liver. If you put it in your gut, it's going into the liver and it's going to be processed. If you put it on the outside of the liver capsule isn't going to let that much in. So, this is one of those studies where the more you read, the more you say, this is getting more and more problematic. So let's talk about this, because I gave you a teaser at the beginning, so I might as well head on in with this. New clinical study suggests that successful root canal treatment may benefit more than just dental health. Patients treated for infected teeth showed improved blood sugar control, healthier cholesterol levels, and reduced inflammation over time. The time interval here was 2 years. Here's how the study worked. King's College London researchers conducted a clinical study examining changes in blood chemistry after their patients received root canal treatment for a common dental infection called apical periodontitis. Now, what that is that's when the tooth is getting loose and there's inflammatory bacteria generating acid and etching away at the bone, at the very base of the teeth. When you have a deep cleaning, they're trying to head off the bacteria going deeper, because once they get that deep, they tend to just keep heading down there. They can allow bacteria from the tooth to enter the bloodstream, and that triggers inflammation. There's also the passive diffusion of bacterial wall breakdown products called lipopolysaccharides, which can also come from a leaky gut. But in this case, you've got a leaky mouth. Those compounds, LPS, trigger something called a toll-like receptor in the immune system and set off a cascade of inflammation, awakening sleeping immune cells to go out and essentially declaring martial law in your bloodstream and a curfew, and taking and shooting anything that's out after curfew, which can include, of course, your own healthy tissues. So they monitored the blood in these patients for up to 2 years after their root canal. There were 65 patients. And during that time, they looked at how their body processed sugar, fats, and important substances. And they used a technique called nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, very advanced technique, to study proteins and other molecules in the blood that have been associated with various conditions. So on the superficial level, with just the standard sorts of blood tests, people experienced improvements in cholesterol and fatty acid levels in the blood. Blood sugar levels dropped significantly during the 2 years following treatment. Indicators of inflammation like hsCRP gradually declined. And so bacteria that are there infecting the teeth, bad bacteria, appear to influence the entire body. The lead author of the study states, "Our findings show that root canal treatment doesn't just improve oral health. It may also help reduce the risk of serious conditions like diabetes and heart disease." I would also add that there are studies that have been out for a while linking gum disease and periodontitis diagnosis with earlier onset of Alzheimer's disease. Longstanding root canal infections can allow bacteria to enter the bloodstream, trigger inflammation, increase blood glucose and fat levels, raising the risk of serious health issues like heart disease and diabetes. Last paragraph is, we need to move towards integrative care, where dentists and general practitioners work together to monitor the risks through these blood markers and protect overall health. I'm going to take just a moment to I'm going to hold out the advice and just take just a moment to say, why is there such a chasm between dentists and doctors? Well, the answer is the AMA. So when the AMA first formed, they wanted to create for themselves a marketing image, a brand, if you will, of being the real scientists. And dentists, well, those were just guys that pulled teeth. And so they didn't want to let the dentists into the AMA, because that would have basically they felt it would impair their brand. And this was actually the discussions that were had at the time. As a result, to the detriment of all of us, when your doctor does your checkup, they look at in your throat, but unless there's like visible black teeth, they rarely even notice your dentition. And I've queried my peers, and none of them look at the gums or look for gum recession or redness or anything like that. So advice to the patients: don't expect your doctor to notice anything that's wrong with your teeth or mouth, except for maybe tongue cancer and pus on your tonsils. And that's too bad, because I think we have more access to people's mouths than dentists do, honestly. Not everybody goes to the dentist. Okay, so either you are going to the dentist or you're not. But anyway, here's two things you can do to reduce your risk of apical periodontitis, as well as lower your cholesterol and lower your risk for diabetes and Alzheimer's. And that's just the stuff we know about. Floss. But also, every 6 months or so, take a metal handle, something narrow, but it should be metal. And just tap one by one on your teeth. You'll have to pull your cheek out with one finger, but just look in the mirror and just tap on the tooth. Tap, tap, tap. Doesn't have to be that hard. Just like tapping a pencil to on a tabletop, that level. It's not, and see if it hurts. If that tooth hurts, it needs to be checked, whether it's got a filling or a cap, which now is called a crown, but essentially whatever that tooth has under it, that needs to be looked at because it shouldn't be hurting from tapping on it. And that is our advice and information on the subject of teeth. And let's take care of that other email we got. We talked about the abdominophrenic dyssynergia, but this one comes from Robert in Maryland. Ask Dr. Don, do you have a podcast on Crohn's and IBS, looking for gut disease and gut-brain access? Well, Robert, I have never done a dedicated podcast on it, but I will take that under advisement as something that I might want to do as a segment on the program at some point in the future. But let's focus on that second thing that you said, the gut-brain axis. First of all, it's a bidirectional communication network running mainly through the vagus nerve. Now, if wherever a person lives in the United States, there's one big highway that's kind of your north-south and another that's your east-west. And depending on where you are, here in California, the big central highway is probably Highway 5, which goes very, very far along the state and is in the center of the state. So most of us who live there spend some time on Highway 5 during our lives. So I want you to think of the vagus nerve as the highway between the brain and the gut. And it has turnoffs that go to other places along the way, very important turnoffs. But basically, it's the main road from the brain to the gut. And the things going from the brain to the gut include neurotransmitters and electrical impulses. And the impulses, the waves of charge that travel down that highway, are coded by time to give commands and information. So it's like a Morse code, if you want to think of it that way. And the other thing that travels are food, energy, stuff that keeps the nerves alive. And what comes back up the vagus nerve are neurotransmitters that are made in the gut, made many of them, most of them, by bacteria breaking down tryptophan and to create serotonin. And then that amino acid that's broken down and turned into serotonin has activity in the gut, improving bowel function in terms of peristaltic waves, for example, which cause things to move along. So the motility of the gut is influenced both from the brain and also locally from the bacteria, which is kind of cool when you think about it. A lot of that serotonin goes up to the brain where it's used, and serotonin is probably the key neurotransmitter for mood and much of cognitive function. So when you think about the amount of nerve tissue in the gut, it's quite a large percentage of the peripheral nerve tissue in our body. So it's almost like another spinal cord in terms of the amount of tissue. And so anything going on in the gut, and particularly an autoimmune or inflammatory disease like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, is going to create chemical signals of alarm. And those, too, will travel back up to the brain, where we know that these alarm signals can result in primarily in depression and inflammation in the brain. But also, we know that some of the stuff that travels up from the gut can accumulate in the brain. And a particularly well-understood example of this is Parkinson's disease. The protein, alpha-synuclein, that accumulates in the parts of the brain that are destroyed in Parkinson's disease is first found in abnormally high levels in the gut about 10 years before the person develops Parkinson's disease, which is just a fascinating tidbit, but I think further underscores this gut-brain connection. Stress, of course, itself is a mediator that increases intestinal permeability. Intestinal permeability allows this bacteria to trigger an immune response by those toll receptors I was talking about earlier. Now, anything that is being damaged or irritated, it's like a vicious cycle. The inflammation that's generated by the mediators, by the stress hormones and the increased intestinal permeability and the increased amounts of bacterial wall fragments getting through there, trigger an immune response. The immune response triggers injury. The injury makes the leaking worse. And if we're going to segue over for a moment and talk about ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, these are autoimmune diseases, and it's a real chicken and the egg situation. They cause a leaky gut. Once you have that inflammation, you take a look at pictures, if you want, online of what the inside of the bowel looks like, and it looks like it's been firebombed. It's just nasty. And these conditions increase the risk of cancer in the individuals, but they also drastically increase the risk of autoimmune disease. And they drastically increase the risk of food allergy, which is also inflammatory and will cause more leaking. And so the whole thing just shreds over time. And we stand by and we watch it and we say, well, we can stop some of this. We have autoimmune antibodies that stop some of the antibody response. And those have been very promising in fixing an attack. But ultimately, these diseases are smoldering forest fires that flare up from time to time. So all of the functional medicine things, a broadly diverse diet where you don't repeat anything very often, an anti-inflammatory diet with lots and lots of healthy fats, lots of omega-3s, lots of omega-3s, lots of vitamin D, lots of variety in terms also if you are eating meat or fish in the types that you eat, because you're trying essentially not to get that part of the immune system going after foods that they see all the time, which we know happens in all individuals if they mono eat. So it's a very important thing. What can you do if you have these diseases and you want to work through the calming effect aspect that the brain is capable of? That's where the mindfulness-based stress reduction has the best results in scientific research. And that would include breathing exercises, guided visualization, meditation. But essentially, if you can calm the brain and raise your parasympathetic tone, that has a direct anti-inflammatory effect. So you can, in fact, do the equivalent of taking a prednisone by changing the signals that your brain is sending down to your gut. Dietary adjustments, a sort of healthy paleo diet, and I mean a healthy paleo diet, which means 80% vegetables and 10% meat. Not, I eat meat and cheese and that makes me paleo. That's not what we're talking about here. The benefit is actually in the roots and vegetables and in the probiotics that they create. And the probiotics are the ones that don't like an inflammatory environment, and they basically send out and modify things to create an environment that suits them, which is a nice, quiet neighborhood without a lot of inflammation. And they can go a long way to turning things around. One of the things we have established as a main therapy for this condition of Crohn's disease is we give people a probiotic transplant from someone with a healthy microbiome. And there are people who actually are essentially saving their poop every day and selling it to one licensed lab in the United States, who then redistributes it to medical centers for the exact purpose of fecal transplant. And the crazy thing is, this works really well. Now, don't do the home version. Don't go online and use, you know, your cousin Betty, who has no medical history, but she'll give you some poop. Don't go there, okay? This is not something you can DIY. I really think that you run very severe personal health risks by doing anything like that. And I want to be sure I put that out there front and center. But really, the use of the drugs to come to combat flares, get the inflammation down, and then taking substances that help rapidly rebuild the barrier functioning of the gut, such as L-glutamine, zinc, as I said, vitamin D, omega-3s. Those are all things that act as building blocks to paper over the holes in the chinks in the armor of the gut, so that it becomes less leaky, and then that helps keep, you know, the leaky gut is like wind. Wind is to a forest fire. You've got some inflammation. The leakage is a force multiplier. Stop the leakage, and the fire burns itself out. So that is the best I can do with a somewhat off-the-cuff description of the gut-brain axis and its implications in inflammatory bowel disease. I've got one very quick one here. It's one of my series, now and then I do medical news of the weird. Well, malaria parasites contain tiny spinning crystals that have puzzled scientists for years. Every cell of the deadly Plasmodium falciparum contains a tiny compartment packed with microscopic iron crystals. And while the parasite is alive, these crystals are in constant motion. They whirl, bounce, collide within their confined space like loose change, shaking violently in a jar, moving so quickly and unpredictably that standard scientific tools have actually struggled to track them. And when the parasite dies, the motion immediately stops. But it's been a huge puzzle. Now, a team has uncovered the mechanism behind this strange behavior. The crystals are driven by a chemical reaction similar to the one used to power rockets. The discovery could point to new strategies for treating malaria, but it also offers insight for designing nanoscale robotic systems. This type of propulsion is well known in aerospace engineering. Hydrogen peroxide is used as a fuel to launch spacecraft, but it's never before been identified in any biological system. Hydrogen peroxide is very abundant within this small compartment that houses the crystals. And the crystals are actually a crystallized form of heme, the protein complex that carries oxygen. The parasite produces this hydrogen peroxide as a byproduct. And when you grow these parasites under low oxygen conditions, that reduces the amount of hydrogen peroxide they can make. The crystals slow down to about half their usual speed. And then if you put it back in oxygen, they speed back up again. Now, hydrogen peroxide is highly toxic. So the spinning crystals may help the parasite break down excess peroxide. But more important, these spinning crystals in these vesicles in Plasmodium falciparum is a self-propelled metallic nanoparticle. It's the first one ever identified, and we are starting to use nanoparticles in medicine, but powering them has been a serious issue. Looking at this hydrogen peroxide heme engine, both biological compounds, which, by the way, we produce hydrogen peroxide as a byproduct of certain chemical reactions, and we have a whole host of compounds like citric peroxide dismutase that are hanging around catalase to break down the hydrogen peroxide before it can go and oxidize our DNA. So we've already got kind of a protective mechanism. We should be able to see if we can steal from this parasite, from this eukaryotic parasite, an engine that will allow us to power tiny robots. And if that's not a cool news of the weird, I don't know what is. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.